This is the Working Drummer Podcast, featuring conversations with ground-level pros from all styles and regions. Real drummers with real stories about making a living in music.
Hey everyone, welcome to Working Drummer Podcast. I'm Zach Alvetta, and today I'm talking with Sean Zorn. Sean is a product of the Memphis scene, where he still lives, but has also made his presence felt in Nashville over the last 5 years. His career is an enviable mix of live and studio, Memphis and Nashville, local and touring, and includes such artists as Twin Forks, Amy Levere, Mike Doty, and many more. A session he recently did with Mike Doty led to the creation of a sample pack called For the Song that is now available on Yurt Rock. We would appreciate your support on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/workingdrummer, and a donation in any amount gets you access to exclusive content from our former guests. Think of this as professional development for drummers, all useful and actionable lessons for the working pro. We're populating new content regularly, and as little as $1 a month gets you access to all of it. If Patreon isn't your thing, you can also make a one-time donation through PayPal. There are links for both on our homepage at workingdrummer.net. While you're there, you can learn more about this episode and check out our archive of over 300 episodes. Also, please subscribe to Working Drummer Podcast on your platform of choice. We're available on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and YouTube, and be sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Lastly, however you listen, please leave us a rating and review. This helps new listeners find us. We have some new Patreon content up. Since a lot of us are doing more tracking lately, we're having some of our guests talk about a specific song they've tracked drums for and all the technical and creative aspects of that recording process. New content there from Don Perry, Jim White, Joe Bergamini, and Steven Chopek, so check that out. Again, that's patreon.com/workingdrummer. So we've been hearing from more Memphis drummers lately. In the last few months, we've talked to Steven Chopek and George Slupik, who both have close ties there, but Sean actually still lives there. It sounds like Memphis lives up to its reputation as a music city in terms of a local live scene, recording work, and touring, and he has a hand in all of it. So let's get to it with Sean Zorn. Played a gig last night. I played a church gig this morning. I taught a Zoom lesson just a minute ago. So, you know, you might be carrying this conversation.
Well, I'm in the exact same boat except for the Zoom lesson. But yeah, gigs last night, church this morning. So you know how it is.
Yep. Are you in Nashville or Memphis right now?
I'm in Memphis.
Cool.
Yeah.
What percentage of your time is it pretty much an even split between Nashville and Memphis?
No, the last, I'd say, 3 or 4 years, it's been primarily in Memphis. I was spending a lot of time back and forth between here and Nashville, like up until like 2016, 2017. Mm-hmm. And in late 2017, I bought a house in Memphis, and I met a girl who I married a couple months ago. So we've kind of been
More
centrally,
those two things will keep you there.
Yeah. So I still get up there quite a bit, you know, but definitely, and especially with everything last year, it was like pretty much based in Memphis for the last little bit.
Cool. So at what point in your career, like, we'll kind of work our way back, but when did you start sort of working your way into Nashville, and how did you do that? And how did you maintain a foot in Memphis? Because most people, when they go to a town like Nashville or LA or New York or something, like, it's all in.
Yeah. Well, so I grew up in Memphis, which is only 3 hours from Nashville. So it's a pretty easy trip.
Yeah.
I went to college for a year at MTSU, which is just south of Nashville. And, at that time, made a lot of friends there and started that was, 2003. And that's when I started regularly going. I would go at least a couple times a year back as far as that. In 2014, I started playing with a band called Twin Forks, which was a side project of this guy, Chris Caraba, who is from the band Dashboard Confessional. Mm-hmm. And those guys are all based in Franklin, right outside of Nashville.
Right. Okay.
So, yeah, when that happened in 2014, I was sort of like pretty heavily, you know, there in Nashville and Franklin, but we were touring a lot. So we'd be in and out, you know, and then, you know, so kind of splitting the time between there, being on the road, coming back, trying to, you know, break in and get the thing going in Nashville. And then also, you know, like you said, keeping a foothold in Memphis. All my family's still here in Memphis, so it was always easy to come back and forth. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that time in Nashville, I was, like I said, I was living in Franklin. I was traveling a lot. I was gigging a little bit in Nashville, but, you know, I when I was off the road, there just seemed to be more going on for me in Memphis, mm-hmm. Which is, you know, kind of counterintuitive, but that's where I came up. So I just had more of a foothold. And like I said, a few years ago, I met the wife and just started, you know, things were really happening for me here in Memphis. So I kind of started to turn back that way.
Yeah. I've been thinking and talking a lot lately about this idea of like sort of having dual citizenship,
right,
in different cities. And for some people it's like more than two cities. But it sounds like, you know, you kind of your entree into Nashville was mainly this project that you were a part of that was kind of operating out of Nashville.
It was, that's right.
So like, did you ever sort of, have designs or ambitions on making Nashville the place?
I did, you know, and, you know, they say it, I guess they used to say it's a 3-year town. Now they say it's probably a 5 or 7 year town. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but yeah. I start to think like, well, so we're talking about 2016 is when I was last like really there. And it's like, okay, well, you know, had I really pressed on it since 2016, you know, who knows how that would have shaken out. But I don't know. At the time, like, it just seemed like all the opportunities that I was coming up with were in Memphis. And I had a couple chances to, like, really stay there. And I don't know why, but at every turn I sort of said, well, you know, this Memphis thing, like, I don't know if it's just more my speed. Like I said, I grew up here, but mm-hmm. I don't know. It's there's something about Memphis that is just way, I don't know. It's the ceiling is certainly lower, but it's a lot more manageable. And there's so much cool stuff going on, you know? And,
I can so relate to that. Cause like I live in Atlanta, which is, mm-hmm. I think like a bigger town with maybe a higher ceiling than Memphis,
absolutely,
but still not as high as Nashville. But I also spent 7 years in Kansas City, which I consider like my second hometown.
Right.
And I've only spent a little bit of time in Memphis, but it strikes me, very much, very similar to Kansas City, just a town with,
that's interesting,
a lot of history, like its own musical identity, its own musical mm-hmm. ecosystem that can be, you know, if you're a part of that scene, you can parlay that into a bigger scene, but you don't have to, like, you can just remain in that scene. And like you said, like there's so much cool shit going on. It kind of keeps you fulfilled and keeps you satisfied and keeps you busy.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I have always liked Kansas City a lot and played there a lot over the years. And like, I get into a lot of like the 90s sort of Midwest emo stuff that was coming out of there. So I have like an affinity for Kansas City, and I've always kind of wondered, you know, what it's like just for, you know, just like a regular working musician up there, you know, like,
yeah,
it seems like there's clubs, it seems like there's stuff going on, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I can only speak to the jazz experience really, because I went there for grad school. I studied jazz, mm-hmm. you know, I stayed there for a few years after school and was just like part of the jazz scene. It was pretty much mm-hmm. just all jazz all the time for me in Kansas City. But you know, there's a huge blues scene, there's a huge indie rock scene, and you're right, there's like a lot of, there's a lot of venues. I mean, I left Kansas City to go to LA.
Okay.
And, I almost wish, you know, I like my then girlfriend, now wife, was in LA, and and just that was the path I was on. Like, I was going west, yeah, and that was it. But I often think that, like, I didn't really get nearly as much as maybe I could have out of Kansas City, just because I was in the jazz bubble. It's where I wanted to be. But, you know, having been away for over 10 years now, I've just sort of seen from afar how much more I could have gotten in on had I stayed there, or had I been, you know, less myopic in my 20s.
Yeah, every time I'm there, we, you know, we sort of dip into these different neighborhoods. It seems like there's all these cool pockets. So that it's just, you know, I play there, you know, two or three times a year most years, and it always seems like somewhere I'd like to spend a little more time and delve into a little more.
Yeah. So, like, as far as your experience on the Memphis scene, was there a particular circle? Was there a particular genre that you were kind of like embedded in, and then, you know, branched out to what else Memphis had to offer?
Yeah, I mean, there is sort of this, like, the like Midtown Memphis scene, which is like, you know, it runs the gamut. I mean, there's lots of like garage rock. There's lots of cool, interesting songwriters. It's all kinds of stuff. And that was sort of, you know, had been my scene. There's an artist here in town who's been around forever. Her name is Amy Levere, and I've been playing with her off and on for about 12 years now. And so she tours with her husband, who's a guitar player named Will Sexton. And they do a lot of duo stuff, so it's really easy to sort of like pop in and out. You know, they don't always need drums. I happen to think it's better with drums, you know. I may be biased in that respect, but you know, that's sort of been my main gig here in town for, like I said, about the last 12 years. But when I started coming back around in 2016 and started to be like, oh, maybe this will be where I'll stay, I started getting a lot more calls to get into the studio world, which is a pretty vibrant thing here in town.
Yeah.
There's lots of live stuff. But there's a lot of active studios and a lot of great songwriters. And that's kind of always been my focus, where I wanted to be. I consider myself like a songwriter's drummer. I'm sure that's probably something that you hear a lot, but I really, I like textures. I like songs. I like lyrics. I've always gravitated towards that kind of thing. And so, you know, being able to back up different songwriters and stuff has been a real, you know, blessing in that respect, I guess, being able to like do all the studio work and that kind of thing.
So. Right. And I think, you know, part of the point of moving to Nashville is to do studio work, right? I mean, the other point is to just get a touring gig. Like the old joke, if it's a joke, is that, like, when you move to Nashville, you know, you get a gig and then, like, you don't live in Nashville anymore. You're just like on the road constantly. But of course, there's tons of session work in Nashville. But I kind of feel like, and maybe you can speak to this because you spend a lot more time there than me, I feel like unless it's your ambition to become the next Chris McHugh and do all those master sessions, whatever session work you're going to do in Nashville is, you know, similar, akin to the session work that you would do in Memphis or Kansas City or Atlanta or in whatever your circle is, right?
Yeah. The guys who are getting those big A-call sessions have pretty much got that locked down.
Yeah. And so, like, from your perspective, you could move to Nashville and kind of, like, create all these new relationships with new artists and still do that session work. But you've already got that going in Memphis. You've already got those relationships. You already like those people, you know?
Totally. Back to your question about, like, having designs on, like, moving to Nashville, and it sort of ties in. Like, I certainly did, and it wasn't ever that I made, like, a very conscious decision, like, oh, I'm going to focus on the Memphis. It was just, like, that's where the phone was ringing, you know? And it was like, oh, okay. Like, suddenly I'm getting all these calls for these things. And, like, you know, ultimately, I have always loved touring. I really you know, there's a thought game that I like to play sometimes where it's like with guys who kind of dip in both. It's like if you had to choose one, either touring or the studio, you know, how would you do it? And I would probably choose to be touring.
I think I would, too. Reason. I think I would, too.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I love being in the studio. I really do. And I do it quite a bit. And it's one of my favorite things. But there's always been that, you know, I've always loved being on the road.
Yeah.
And
I wish
there was a little bit. Go ahead.
No. Well, you go ahead. No.
I was going to say, if Memphis is lacking in one thing, it's certainly there's not that much touring work coming out of, you know, that stuff is certainly all based out of Nashville and probably Atlanta and Austin, you know, but
right.
You know,
What I was going to say is that, you know, I think the pandemic has crystallized a lot of things for a lot of musicians.
Certainly.
And during the pandemic, I basically got my home tracking rig and game like up and running. And it's been really educational and motivating and, you know, just something that I've been wanting to do for a long time, and I'm going to continue to do it, and I really love doing it. But what the pandemic made me realize is that for me, playing music with people in front of people is still plan A.
Like, yeah, yep.
On stage is where I want to be, and, you know, in the studio is great, and I love doing it, and I will, you know, continue to, but... just that experience, especially being on the road, like, you know, playing live on your scene in Atlanta or Memphis or whatever. Great. But, you know, being on the, I haven't done enough road work to be sick of it yet. Right. Like you run into those musicians
who are jaded.
Right. They're just over it. And I totally understand how at a certain point you can just be over it, but, I'm nowhere near over it. That's where I want to be.
It's certainly like we're finding out over the course of this that we have an awful lot in common. From our schedule last night and this morning to everything we got going on.
We better not move to the same town. It's going to cause
I also did the same thing. And I think a lot of people did with trying to get the home rig up and running. And I got a little thing going. I've gotten some cool stuff. I dipped into, here working at the house doing like some TV recordings, you know, like for like placement stuff, with a friend of mine who's in Nashville that does that. And I've been able to do that remotely. And that's been awesome, especially, you know, during that year when we were all at home, not doing much else.
Right.
And, you know, I'm guessing you're a lot like me where it's like I've gotten it where I can come up with some pretty cool stuff that's good, solid tones. Sounds good, but I'm far from being like an engineer by any means. You know, it's like I can get something that you can mix and that'll sound good.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I struggle with, you know, I don't know how far down the mixing rabbit hole you've gone.
Not very far, not as much as I should have.
Well, me neither. And I wonder how much time or money or, you know, effort I should really invest in it when, I think most of what I'm ever going to do in my home studio is just, you know, tracking, like sending somebody raw tracks, right? Like people aren't going to be asking me to mix shit. So like what goals or obstacles formed in your mixing game?
I mean, just the fact that I know guys who are so much better at it, you know,
right.
And so, I know a lot of engineers that are better at it, but then I look at guys like, I don't know, Dan Bailey and whatnot. And it's like, well, these guys have been doing this for years.
Yeah,
and
man.
Their game is,
you
know, and it's just like, I feel like I'm 10 years too late to the game. So, you know,
It's funny you mentioned Dan.
I don't know.
It's funny you mentioned Dan Bailey because I interviewed him, I don't know, a year ago or something. But I quote him a lot because we were having this conversation about, you know, there's so many engineers that are better and blah, blah, blah. And Dan said, Like, I don't get hired because I'm a great engineer. I get hired because I'm great at engineering my playing in my room.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, his mixing game, as you mentioned, is light years beyond any of ours. But I think he's still approaching it from that perspective. Like, I'm working with these tones on my drums, with my mics in my room. And that's kind of his first principles, right? And that's how I'm operating. Like, get good tones, and you know, you likely won't have to mix them. And if you do have to mix them, just do no harm.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's, I try and provide good, clear tones, you know, and let you roll with it, you know.
Right.
And like I said, I just know, you know, I know so many good engineers in town, and it's just like, it's so much easier to just take it to one of my buddies. You know what I mean? So, I'm really happy with what I have done in here. I have sort of fallen by the wayside in the last 6 months or so, now that, like, I'm starting to gig again, and, and there, you know, there's more studio work cropping back up. But, you know, like many of us, it was just in that time, you know, last year, it was like, okay, well, at the very least, even if it's not like further income stream, this is a good chance to like spend the time and try and level up these skills, you know? And,
yeah, for sure.
The recording and engineering and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
It always seems so insurmountable, and it turns out it's not, you know? I mean, it's obviously like there's a big difference between being great at it, but like, it's not as hard as you think, you know? Like,
yep. I had the exact same experience. Like, it just seemed so, I mean, I was intimidated. I was really intimidated by the whole thing.
Yeah.
But when I finally just sort of took the plunge and started messing around at very rudimentary levels with what I had, you know, the mysteriousness of it all quickly sort of dissipated and was like, oh, this isn't a magic trick. Like, regular people can do this. If you had the same experience, like, doing so much of my playing in here over the last couple of years, and it's coincided with taking a couple lessons with Dave Elitch and like kind of reworking my physical approach. But I wonder if, like, you mentioned now, you know, you're getting other session work, the gigging life is starting to rev back up again. Are you, like, what are you taking out of your home tracking, like the playing experience of tracking at home? What are you taking from that out in, you know, back into the world?
I don't, you know, that's a good question. I mean, yeah, I don't know. Aside from just like spending that much more time playing, you know, playing with click tracks and stuff, and really like just internalizing all that so much more. I mean, I had, you know, doing studio stuff has been a pretty regular thing for the last so many years. So it's not really like learning how to play with, like, for microphones or like to, you know, flirt around with a click and play, you know, on top of or behind it. You know, that stuff has been sort of these tools that I've been honing for several years. So in that respect, there hasn't been like all that much learning there. It's more, like I said, just learning where to put the microphones and how to gain everything right and that kind of thing. So
right,
that doesn't translate so much into like the live stuff, but, you know, certainly like being on sessions now, I'm way more paying attention to what these engineers are doing, there's a lot to learn, and as you do it more, you realize how much there is to learn, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I was talking with my buddy, Q Robinson, who's a great Atlanta drummer, a couple days ago, and we were kind of having this conversation, and, tracking in here, you know, in, in confluence with all the physical stuff I've been working on with Illich. Now when I, like when I go out on a gig or a session, I'm really trying to be so clear and so intentional with what I play.
Yeah.
Because in here, like if you're going for a certain sound or certain tones, like you have to be intentional about, you know, how, like you said, how you place the mics, how you play in the room. It's just, I feel so much more mindful about my playing.
Yes.
And as a result, my playing has like simplified, you know, I don't, I've kind of gone back to square one, physically. So I'm just not able to do, you know, some of the fancier shit that I was able to do, but that came with bad habits, you know, bad motion
that's
bad
the
tone
Illich thing.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
How are you liking those lessons with Illich?
Man, it's been a game changer.
Breaking it like, down, huh?
Yeah, like it's what everybody says, but I'm no different. It's really changed my perspective about just how to move behind the kit and how that affects your sound, how that affects your time, and how that affects how you feel.
Yeah, I did one with him a few years ago, a Zoom, you know, thing, and it was beneficial, and he definitely like, you know, he seized on my grip quick, you know, and we spent a lot of time and like, you know, it's like you say, it's easy to fall into these habits, you know what I mean? But like, man, I would love to have the opportunity to like spend some real time in person. You know what I mean?
Cause
he obviously knows what he's doing, you know?
Yeah.
I've developed in the last couple of weeks, this, pain in my elbow that I feel like it's like, oh shit, maybe I need to, need to really address this,
man,
you know,
here like, it comes.
I know.
Yeah.
Not in my 20s anymore.
I got with him because, first of all, I turned 40, I'm 41 now, but,
congratulations.
Thank you. after I turned 40, I started having weird, like stiffness and pain in my right hip. And it was around the same time that Matt, my partner in Nashville, interviewed Illich. And I was aware of Illich before, but I had never really dug into like, what is his thing? What is it about? And, it, you know, I listened to him talk, I watched him play, and I just realized like, I have some bad shit going on. And if I don't address it now, I might be broken by the time I'm 50. I'm just trying to kind of get back on a, or not back, but get on a good physical path kind of for the first time in my life. It's been super beneficial just with how I approach the instrument and how it affects my sound. It's not just about how I feel like during or after playing. It's about, you know, the tones that are coming out and the ideas that are coming out. So that in conjunction with like being super aware of tones and all that shit in the studio, I feel like everything I'm playing is simpler, but it all just feels better and it all sounds and feels clearer.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that should be the goal, you know?
Right. And see, like now I'm looking at the next step. It's not unlike the, you know, the recording journey. It's like you reach a milestone and then all you see is the next dozen fucking milestones that you haven't done yet.
Yeah.
So now that I've got some of this like comfort and clarity and flow with very simple shit, I'm looking at, you know, Illich or, you know, somebody else and being like, look how much flow they have with unbelievable shit.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you do those lessons, are they primarily like on the pad or,
no,
have you actually been on the kit?
Yeah, I've been on the kit. And for the first lesson, like I hardly played a note. I mean, we talked about how to sit for 45 minutes, because my posture was just too far forward. Like my spine was pretty straight, but it was all just like leaning forward. I was just sort of craned out over the kit. So like that connected with, you know, the way I was using the kick, I was burying the beater. I was sending all sorts of tension up my leg into my right hip. So like a different way to sit and a different way to play the kick, you know, were very much connected. So that was the first, that was just most of the first lesson. And then the second lesson, we got more into sort of moving around the kit a little bit more and just like taking the basic, default posture and default movement and moving it past kick, snare, hi-hat.
Right.
Sounds, you know, totally simple. But for me, you know, as soon as I moved off the kick snare hi-hat, I could feel myself just like, oh, I'm fucked now. So the second lesson, he had to give me some tools to like just, you know, continue to be mindful as I move around the kit.
Yeah, I could use a hand with that kind of stuff. My posture is not ideal, but, you know, and really, you know, I've not a heavy hitter. You know, I've played in some rock bands and I can do it, but it's not my default state. You know what I mean? I am used to trying to please songwriters, you know what I mean? And I want to
totally
not get in their way. And I, you know what I'm saying? And so I have never really come into any sort of physical problems just because I'm not exerting that much energy. And, but you know, getting older, it starts, you know, and it's like, you have to address these things, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I see pictures of myself and my shoulders up and it's like, yeah, you got to stop that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I was starting to have like a little bit of an issue with my hip, like I said, and a little bit of an issue with my back. There was nothing debilitating really. But the main reason I got with him, is just cause I felt like blockage. I didn't feel pain. I just felt like this sort of blockage and tightness in my playing. I'm not a heavy hitter. And Elitch just beats the piss out of the drums, you know, I saw him play and I was like, I don't want to hit that hard. I don't want to sound like that. That's him. That's not me. But I want to move like that. I want to feel the way he feels. And it worked. Like his approach, I think is almost universal for, you know, any kind of player, regardless of your tendencies or your genre or whatever. Cause it's all about just the most basic principles of how the human body moves. Anyway, enough of the Elitch commercial. This interview is supposed to be about you.
Yeah, I think he owes us some money at this point.
Yeah, I might get a free 15 minutes out of him. Another artist that you seem to have played with quite a bit is Mike Doty, who is I love that dude's music. I've never met him. I've never gotten to play with him, but I've followed him kind of off and on for a while, and he just seems like an interesting kind of genre defying artist. And I'm wondering, you know, what exactly, you know, in what capacity did you play with him, and what did you sort of get out of that?
Yeah, I know. I know you had our mutual friend Stephen Chopek on. And Stephen did a lot of touring with him. And so what happened was, you know, Mike moved to Memphis. I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago, maybe.
From New York.
From New York. He was a New York guy all through the 90s, and let me just say, absolutely agree with you, like, those soul coughing records and his solo stuff too. It's like, he's such a talented artist and such cool ideas and sounds. And, it's gone now, but there used to be this bar in Memphis called the Buccaneer. And it was sort of, it was a musician's hang. It was a shitty little dive bar, but it was where all of the coolest, you know, most interesting music was happening in town.
You need that place.
And it was really a gem. I was sorry to see it go. I used to have a weekly Wednesday night gig there, but there is a guitar player who's an older cat named David Kowser. And David is a brilliant guitar player. Maybe the most brilliant musician I've ever encountered in my life. But the point is, he forever had this Tuesday night residency there for years and years and years. And he started doing this thing where he put together this kind of collective that was all improvisational. And it would be, you know, a couple guitars, saxophone, bass, and then a lot of times at least two drummers. And a lot of times that would be me and Stephen Chopek did a lot of that together.
Oh, cool.
very cool stuff. And Mike just kind of started showing up to these gigs. Like, I didn't know him, but the word, you know, had kind of gotten around the Midtown scene, like, oh, you know, Mike Doty moved to town. And he started showing up, and he would kind of just come and join our little collective, and he would just start freestyling. And he has such this like amazing flow with his words and, you know, the way syllables and stuff sound together. And it totally fit into what we were doing. And he sort of, it was a loose collective without a name. And he kind of, you know, became a sort of de facto, band leader for a while and started calling it Spooky Party. We were doing that. Yeah. He's a, like I said, good with words, but, So we started doing that, a lot of like improv gigs where, you know, there'd just be a handful of us just kind of playing, you know, whatever and feeding off each other. And that's how I got to know him, doing that. And then I recently did a session with him, here in town, and he called me up and, said, "Do you have the date? You know, here's, you know, be there at this time." And that was all he told me. I had no idea what we were doing. Okay. So I show up and we set up two drum kits, and the whole thing was, it was all like loop based.
Forks Drum Closet, Nashville's full line drum store. Celebrating its 40th year in business, Forks is independently owned and operated in the heart of Music City. Specializing in drums and percussion, Forks offers great discounts on all major brands and will beat any retailer's advertised price. From new and used equipment, vintage drums, and marching and orchestral instruments, Forks has something for every drummer. They also offer professional rental repair and restoration services, as well as drum lessons. Stop by their storefront at 308 Chestnut Street, Nashville, Tennessee, 37210. Or call 615-838-8343 or go online at ForksDrumCloset.com.
Which I had never done before. You know, I think I got the impression that this is something he does a lot. Mm-hmm. But, you know, my thing is, it tends to be either, you know, playing along with somebody's tracks, or it's five of us in a room together tracking at the same time.
Right. And in either case, you learn the fucking song and play the fucking song.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And you're reacting to, again, to, you know, to lyrics and to a form and, you know, a vibe. And this was him sitting next to the drums, and he would sing a rhythm to me, or he would play it on a computer. He would have different things, and he would he'd sing it to me, and then I would start playing it. He'd give a tempo, you know, do this at 1:30 and do or whatever, you know, and I would do it. And after about four bars, he'd put his hand up and he'd say, "That's great." And then he would move on. And we did that for about 4 hours. And
wow.
it was a blast, but it was one of the strangest sessions I've ever been a part of. And maybe people will hear this and go, "Yeah, I do that all the time," but I had never done that before.
Yeah.
And, he basically just created a little library, you know, from me for him, I guess.
Wow.
And I have yet to hear what he's done with it. This was just a few months ago. So, you know, and like I said, we had two kits. So we'd get a vibe or a feel going, and he'd be like, you know, "Great, now go over there and do that on that kit." And we'd run across the room and do the same thing on a different kit, or, you know, and it was very fun.
His latest thing, I was just looking it up on Spotify because I couldn't remember the name of the record, and it has I knew it had a cheeky name and I wanted to remember it. His latest thing is the Ghost of Vroom.
Ghost of Vroom.
The Ghost of Vroom.
Yeah.
Which I listened to in the car recently, which was really cool. But that was kind of before you did this session. Whatever you did with him is
that was
yet to be born.
And I think even those things he's built in different ways. Some of it's been, like we said, like three or four people on the floor, and I think some of it's been heavily loop based.
Mm-hmm.
The cool thing that came out of that was Mike had a pretty hard out that day. Like I said, we did it for about 4 hours, and then he basically peaced out quick. Hmm. And me and the engineer, who's a guy named Scott McEwen, we were kind of just there like, "Well, we have these drums and we have all these mics. Like, you want to just play around for a while?" And it's sort of parlayed into we made a loot pack on our own, which I know you talked about with George, and I know that's with George Slethick, I should say. And this is the same engineer who did George's.
Oh, cool. Same studio or
Slethick? Same studio, same engineer. Yeah. So I sort of bit George's idea there. So thanks, George.
It's not just his idea. It seems like, you know.
Well, no, absolutely.
You used to have to have a website. Now you have to have like a podcast and a sample pack and a.
So we've got that out now. It's out through Yurt Rock, which is the same thing that George did.
Oh, you know? Right. Yeah. Cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that was cool. That was like a super fun, also very new experience for me, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And has it, I'm curious about this. I think I talked with, George and maybe somebody else about this, about the idea of like, you know, you're going to create a loot pack. You're going to create a sample pack. Mm-hmm. But how are you going to sell it and who are you going to sell it to? Do you have the name recognition and the clout to do that? Or are you going to rely on, you know, the engineer or the producer that you did it with or the platform that you're putting it on, like Yurt Rock? Or, you know, is it going to be some combination of all those things?
Right. Unclear. Remains to be seen. I got my little thing, you know, and I'm not famous by any means. And I made the mistake of looking shortly before we recorded it, I made the mistake of looking at the Yurt Rock roster, which I don't know if people have seen that, but
yeah,
it's pretty impressive. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I would say I'm probably the biggest nobody on the site, but, you know, I got a thing, and, so does Scott, the engineer who did it. And I think Yurt Rock. So, it remains to be seen. Maybe, hopefully the joke is not on the Yurt Rock guys, and hopefully people will buy the thing, but you know,
yeah.
If nothing else, you know, I think it's a great calling card. I think it's a great, you know, way to sort of show people what I'm about, I hope people are buying it. I hope people will check it out. You know, I think there's some really cool stuff. We tried to really approach it like, not to keep harping on it, but I really consider myself to be a songwriter's drummer and a supportive player. And so I tried to put some ideas down that would be inspiring, simple, you know, tasteful, like just different feels, different tempos, different ideas that would hopefully, you know, if not, that wouldn't, they would say, oh, this is the perfect thing for my song. It might be like, oh, well, this, you know, I could write this around this, you know, or that kind of thing.
Yeah. So, well, I was going to ask, like, you know, it sounds like George made a sample pack that is just Memphis as fuck. Like,
just
lean so hard into that and who better to do it?
I don't know if you know this, but that's a very popular shirt around town. It says Memphis as fuck on it. Yeah,
that's great.
You can see those all over town.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's like a great thing about a town like Memphis. Like that's something that would show up in KC, you know? That wouldn't necessarily show up in a town like Nashville or LA. Like things about Nashville or LA that are Nashville as fuck or LA as fuck, but like, I don't know. It's that sort of the civic pride of like a second or third tier city that I'm really attracted to.
No, you nailed it.
When it came to, you made me realize something else about a loot pack, which is that like, you got to have an angle, right? Like when a producer or a songwriter, whoever is going to use these, is perusing the menu of sample packs, you know, it's got to be like really clear what you're offering, right?
Right.
And then, you know, beyond that, it has to live up to the title, right? So, I mean, George may as well have called his loot pack Memphis as fuck and it lives up to it.
Yeah.
How did you sort of present this sample pack? Does it have a name? And what, like you kind of talked about, you know, things that would be useful to a songwriter. What are those exactly? Tonally, groove wise, what have you?
Yeah. Well, it's called For the Song, which, you know,
great.
It's very, very original, but it says what it is.
Yeah,
you
man.
Know? And, yeah, we just wanted to, try and make it inspirational. So, I mean, I have, sort of a tempo range that I think a lot of like the stuff that I have done, kind of falls into, you know. Mm-hmm. So it was a lot of like these cool sort of mid-tempo or, you know, different grooves, you know, and just different textures and sounds. Like none of it is, you know, I've never been like a heavy chops guy, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I have always wanted to be supportive, and you know, I like, you know, a lot of what I do is playing 2 and 4. You know what I mean?
Yep.
It really is. But it's like the right tones, the right touch, you know, switching out, you know, cymbals. I love cymbals. A lot of engineers don't. I take a little pride in the fact that I think that I have, you know, I'm able to make engineers like cymbals,
yeah,
you know, somewhat.
Yeah.
'Cause a lot of times you start putting up a bunch of cymbals and you start getting the evil eye from singers and from engineers. But, you know, singers did not like cymbals. But yeah, so it's just a lot of like cool feels, cool tones. We used an old 60s Slingerland that belonged to the studio, and we used a early 70s. It's a Pearl fiberglass kit that I've had forever, and it's a total beater, but it sounds awesome. Like it's just such a cool kit.
Yeah.
And, different. And then the other thing we used is, during the pandemic, doing live streams and that kind of thing, I built this, what we're calling the apartment rehearsal kit, but it's like, it's basically just a little, acoustic sort of quiet kit, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I've never liked the cajon. I'm no offense to anybody who plays the cajon, but it's I've seen guys that can really do it, and that's not me, you
right,
know.
Right.
But I said, how can I approach that like sort of vibe, you know, the quiet, you know, a few different tones that you can sort of make these cool loops and rhythms out of. And so I took a timbali and I tuned it way down, and I taped up the head, and I used that as a kick drum.
Hmm.
And then I have a 70s Gretsch snare that I have kind of all taped up, and it's pretty lo-fi, but it ended up coming out really cool. And it has this sort of like Phil Spector garagey vibe. And
yeah, like when you talked about,
it came out cool.
When you talked about like, you know, sort of singer friendly or song friendly tones, mm-hmm. I started thinking of like, you know, pretty warm, kind of crunchy, lo-fi.
Yep.
You know, just low key, kind of, you know, mid tempo, yep. down tempo. That's really cool, man. And yeah, I agree with you about the fucking cajon. I hate it. I've been asked to
it's
play
not
it.
My vibe.
I've been asked to play it a couple of times. I think I actually played it once. And, you know, I mean, first of all, the fact that I'm 6'5", it's just,
I'm
not going
to fucking
do it.
It's hard to look cool hunched over like that.
God, and it's just so uncomfortable. every time I see it, I just think of Harry Myrie calling it the participation box.
That's perfect. Yeah, I had one for a while, and it was like, I hate it. And I actually sold it like a year and a half ago, and literally got a call the next day from somebody being like, we were thinking you could bring a cajon. And I was like, no, I will not.
I will not. I will bring a small bass drum. I will bring a small bass drum, and I'll play it quietly. And
this other thing I made.
No one will be the wiser. Last thing I wanted to ask you about was just sort of, you know, Memphis drummer. Like, you're born and raised in Memphis, right? So, mm-hmm. So
yeah, I moved here when I was five, so close enough.
Okay, that yeah. counts. Yeah, I moved to New Mexico when I was five, and that's, yeah, I get it.
Yep.
So, like, as you were coming up and, you know, into your adulthood and maybe even now, who are a few of the Memphis drummers that really sort of made an impression on you or who you may have, you know, modeled your playing or your, you know, your career model after?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I was sort of for the first like 10 years of my drumming career I grew up in the suburbs, you know, and wasn't really paying that much attention to what was happening at the time. And I certainly was a little ignorant on my history, you know. And then in about 2010, I moved into town, into Midtown, and that's what really kicked off the career in earnest, I guess. Mm-hmm. And since then got to discover guys like Gene Chrisman, you know, who is a huge influence, you know. I don't know if you're familiar with Gene Chrisman.
I'm not.
He was a the Memphis Boys, the American Studio Sound, just look it up. Like it's wild. The amount of stuff these guys played on, Son of a Preacher Man, all kinds of stuff.
It's like the Memphis Wrecking Crew.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You nailed it. You know, they backed up Elvis. These guys were insane. And, one of the first John Prine record was recorded, with all these guys, and just a groove and a feel, you know. And that's kind of like, that's been my whole thing, you know. And
right,
so he was a big influence once I kind of came around to it, which was woefully late, unfortunately. But there's guys like Howard Grimes who are still around, you know. Like there's so many great players in town, and there's a whole new batch, you know. It's like there's just, I don't know, there's a lot to be inspired by, you know.
Yeah, and it sounds like at first, at least, was it Gene Chrisman?
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of through the records, the discography, that you sort of discovered and began to appreciate him, not necessarily going to see him play in town.
No, I've never seen him play.
Yeah.
I've met him, but I've never seen him play.
So, I mean, do those guys, like, do they still play? Is that...
They do. Gene in particular is a Nashville guy now. He's actually been touring with Dan Auerbach for the last little bit. But he's around, you know. They do the big celebrations of Elvis, you know, Death Week and Birth Week every year. And these guys come back around, and I was playing a little hotel bar gig in the Graceland Hotel a couple years ago. And here comes Gene Chrisman walking through the room, and it's like, holy shit, you know. And, we were probably playing a track that he played on.
Right.
You know? And like, he kind of stopped and tipped his hat, and I, you know, did the little nod and off he went. You know,
that's cool.
Like, it's wild.
That's really cool.
You know?
So what's coming up for you? Are you about to hit the road? You got more sessions lined up? How are you sort of re-entering gig life?
Yeah. Session stuff is happening. Got some things coming up. I'll be up in Ohio this weekend doing some gigs and a little bit of tour stuff, you know, coming towards the end of the year. December, it's probably going to slow way down as it does, but yeah. I'm doing local stuff. There's some potential touring that's, you know, that's being bandied about for February. Unclear yet if that's going to materialize, but you know, that's certainly, like I said, something I would like to get back to doing more in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
It
sounds like you're in the same boat that a lot of us are in, where like, you know, there's some stuff starting to take shape. Like the close to home stuff is coming back. And, you know, some of the loftier stuff is like, well, yeah, maybe in the spring, this looks like maybe it could be a thing, but like,
yeah,
still not completely sure.
Yeah. But I've got a handful of groups that I play with that I've been playing with for a while, and they sort of keep me busy. And you know, what I have a group with this guy named Zach Myers, who's in a band called Shinedown, who is they're like the biggest rock band in the world. They just passed Tom Petty for the most number one rock singles of all time. And
what
they yeah they're massively huge arena rock band. He and I have, I've known him since I was a kid. Wow. And he and I and some other guys have a side project together, and you know, that gets busy. We've got some stuff coming up, but then, you know, a lot of these guys have their main gigs and they got to get back to them, you know, after having taken a year off. So,
right.
It remains to be seen how that's going to, how the next year is going to kind of shake out. Like there's definitely a gold rush for, you know, getting back on the road and, you know, clubs and time and all that. So,
yeah. Yeah.
It's encouraging though. Things are happening again.
Yeah. I'm going to have to look up Shinedown as soon as we get off. Like I'm hoping that I'm going to hear one or two of their songs and I'm going to be like, oh yeah, that band. But
I think you will.
If they're a huge arena rock band and they surpass Tom Petty with number one hits and I don't know about it, that's going to be like a God damn it, I'm old moment.
yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah, it's wild.
Like, oh, man. Anyway, hopefully wish me luck.
Yep.
Well, man, it was great talking to you, man. Thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, you too, Zach. I'm glad we got to do this.
Yeah, and I'll say hi to Steven next time I see him. And
he's really doing the Atlanta thing.
Yeah, man, we're glad to have him here. I'm looking forward to seeing kind of what he brings to the scene. I'm sure, you know, either from a drumming perspective and a just kind of a front man, you know, singer songwriter perspective. It's going to be cool. And
he's,
you know,
great. Love that guy.
I'm sure you and I will, you know, I'll find myself in Memphis. So you'll find yourself in ATL before too long. So let's find each other.
For sure. Absolutely.
Right on. Great talking with you, man.
Well, hey man, thanks for taking the time.
Once again, thanks to Sean Zorn. Good getting to know him a bit. Look forward to hearing the results of that interesting session he did with Mike Doty. And you can check out his For the Song sample pack at yurtrock.com. Next week, Matthew Krause will be talking with Jake Summers, a recent transplant from New York to Nashville. Jake is a former student of Dom Familaro and is playing with Luke Combs. Hope you check that out. Until then, stay safe, get vaxxed, and thanks for listening. Cheers.